Oh, Father, tell me, do we get what we deserve? Oh, we get what we deserve. And we're down, we go, go.
Well, hello and welcome to Taproom Talks. I'm Wim Benz, and in the studio with me, as always, is Craig and Zach, our creative team. Say hi, guys.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
All right, so today we have two very awesome people on the line. We have Neil Witte, who is the training and technical support manager at Duvel Mortgat, but works out of Boulevard Brewing Company. He literally wrote the book for the Brewers Association on draft quality. He wrote the draft quality manual, which then gets used by everyone in the industry. It is the it's the draft Bible. And then we also have Ray Daniels, who has had a very long career in the brewing industry. Ray is the founder and director of the Cicerone Certification Program. He is a formal faculty member at the Siebel Institute and has held various positions at the Brewers Association and is an Aggie. So, yeah. Hi, guys. Welcome to the program. All right. So we're just going to dive right in. We got a lot of questions. So today we're going to be talking about what really happens to beer after it leaves the brewery. You know, as brewers and as makers of beer, we do a lot to put as much quality into the beer as we can, sourcing raw ingredients to putting it through the process, all the way to the point where we package it either in a bottle or a keg. But after that, brewers kind of lose a little bit of control over the quality of their beer. It either gets distributed, self-distributed, or it goes through the distribution network, and that can, you know, be local, as it is in our case. It, you know, travels within the state. For larger breweries, it can travel all the way across the United States or even internationally. So, you know, we want that person that's going to be drinking our beer to have the best experience possible, and we have the two experts that can help us along the way and help us make the best out of our beer drinking experience. So Ray, first question to you. Tell us, give us a little bit of history on the Cicerone Certification Program.
The Cicerone Program was I put together in 2007, and we launched on January 3rd of 2008. And the real motivation for the Cicerone Program was bad beer. You know, for the several years before that, I'd been working for the Brewers Association, promoting craft beer around the United States in a lot of different ways, and traveling around the country and, you know, drinking the paycheck, drinking American craft beer. And I found an awful lot of places did it really poorly, that they didn't know anything about the beer, and they knew even less about quality beer and how to, you know, present beer in a quality way to consumers. And so my goal was really to try and motivate people to learn more and become more professional in their presentation of beer.
That's awesome. So how many, there are levels to the Cicerone program, right?
Yes, are four levels.
Okay, so how do those work?
Well, first level is certified beer server. And that is the most basic, you know, information and capabilities related to beer. And it's really, you know, the levels are kind of tied into job positions. And so certified beer server, you know, is what it says. It's for the frontline wait staff, frontline customer service folks who need to have a basic understanding of quality and handling issues related to beer, and who need to know enough about beer styles and beer flavor to have a useful and meaningful conversation with consumers. So that's the first level. Second level is certified Cicerone, and we look at certified Cicerone as a mature beer professional, someone who you could sort of give them the keys to your beer program, if you will, at retail, and you know, be confident that they would not run things off the tracks, at least over the course of a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who, you know, knows enough to do basic beer and food pairings, train the wait staff on new styles, new beers, write descriptions for new beers when they come into the bar, supervise the operation and maintenance of the draft system, do the buying of the beer, all those sorts of things, and also be able to have a meaningful and professional liaison with the rest of the people in the beer community. If they get a beer that doesn't taste the way that brand is supposed to taste, we hope that a certified Cicerone can call the brewery and use, you know, words to describe what that problem is.
Say, right.
Hey, you know, we got your beer, and there's a lot of diacetyl in this beer. And that's a much more meaningful, useful conversation to have between retailer and brewer than to call it up and say, hey, your beer tastes like crap. You know, you need to come get this out of here.
Right.
So we're trying to improve that communication channel. So that's Certified Cicerone. And as I said, that's sort of the, you know, mature beer professional. And that's sort of the recommended level for beverage managers, beer program managers at retail. Craft and especially beer sales representatives at distributors, and also for sales and marketing staff and brewery management on the brewery side as well.
Okay.
And we've got quite a distinguished cadre of certified Cicerones out there. And sometimes it's a bartender who's trying to get ahead and looking for, you know, looking to get promoted into a new job. And we've got a bunch of, you know, brewery CEOs who are certified Cicerones, guys like Greg Cook at Stone Brewing.
Right, right. So then, after being a certified Cicerone, then you go to the next level, right?
Yeah, there's two levels above that. It used to be that you went straight from certified Cicerone to master. And the master Cicerone exam is a two-day-long exam. And it's very intense. It really requires a vast amount of resources for us just to put that exam on. And we found that there were what we found was the demand for the master exam was just overwhelming, and that we weren't able to anywhere near meet that demand. And that a lot of the people taking the master exam felt like the step up between certified and master was just too big. To be able to manage all in one step. And we heard that from people who didn't pass the master. We also heard it from people who did pass the master, sometimes on their second or third attempt, that we needed to have something in between certified Cicerone and master. And so a year ago, we announced creation of the advanced Cicerone exam, which is between certified and master. And earlier this year, we started running advanced Cicerone exams. And within, I think, next year, anybody who's a certified Cicerone who wants to get the master is going to have to take advanced first. And right now, we actually have 13 advanced Cicerones and 11 master Cicerones.
Okay. That's a very hard group to break into. So of those 13 and 11, you know, those very low number of individuals that actually achieve that level, how many people are applying? How many people are taking the test?
Well, the master the ELM master exam is around 9 to 10%.
Oh wow!
So it's a tough road. By the way, you know, you did a great introduction of Neil a few minutes ago. You forgot to mention his most important criteria, most important accomplishment
in
the context of this conversation, and that is that Neil's a master Cicerone.
Well, absolutely. I was going to get to it.
Blew our segue. Come on.
Yeah, Neil is one of the 11.
One of the 11,
Absolutely.
Do you have a number, like, you know, 7 of 9? Are you like 3 of 11?
7 of 11.
Well, I passed at the same time as one of the other Master Cicerones, Marilla Amato, and we were, I believe, 4 and 5. So
nice.
I concede 4 to her. So I always tell people that.
Yeah, so top five's great. Yeah.
Top five's good. Top five's good. We'll take that.
Yeah, I think when two people pass in the same exam, we assign them their numbers on alphabetical by last name.
Oh, there you go.
Was going to lose that no matter who else was in the list.
Exactly. Well, that, you know, we do. I have been seeing a lot more certified servers, which has been really great. You know, we in Dallas we're still kind of a young craft beer market, but I have seen a lot of people at least get their server certification. We want everyone at the brewery to at least have that, and there have been a couple of people at the brewery who have gone for their certified Cicerone certification.
Yeah, a few of them do have the certified.
You know, not only in the brewery side of things have people really piqued an interest in that, but I have seen a lot of bartenders and a lot of servers not just aware of the Cicerone program, but are also actively pursuing moving up into the program. So that's been really exciting. And you know, Ray, like you said, I think it only does good things for craft beer. You know, we get calls every now and then saying, "Hey, your beer tastes poopy." Well, that doesn't help me, you know. And is it the beer or is it your draft system? So Neil, you're kind of the end all be all of draft beer systems, installs, troubleshooting, quality control. How did you land that gig?
Well, I started at Boulevard Brewing Company back in 1997 as a brewer. And after working as a brewer for about 3 years, the founder of Boulevard, John McDonald, decided he wanted to have someone working out in the market, taking care of the beer after it leaves the brewery. Because as you said at the beginning of the show, there's a lot of things that can happen to beer out in the marketplace. And most of them are bad, if not all of them. You know, we can go to great lengths to make a really awesome beer, and, you know, we took care of it all along the way until it went out the door, and we didn't really have anybody kind of shepherding the beer through the rest of its life until it reaches the consumer. And so I took on that role in 2000 and really just started to dive into draft beer to start, because that was really, you know, where the biggest problems were manifesting themselves was with draft systems, because, you know, their draft systems are so different. They're many and varied, and there's so many things that can happen inside a draft system that can screw your beer up. And so I really, you know, taught myself everything that I could about how draft systems work and how they're maintained and cleaning lines and installing them. And I worked with draft techs and line cleaners over the course of many years and learned everything I could and, you know, did my best to make sure that Boulevard beer was being taken care of along the way. And, you know, and in the process, you know, and that's one of the cool things about craft beer, and the cool thing about the job I've been doing, is that when I'm helping out Boulevard and when I'm out there taking care of Boulevard beer on a draft system, it's really helping everybody else's beer too, because if I'm making sure somebody's putting in a great system, they're not just pouring my beer, they're pouring everybody else's beer too. So, you know, it's kind of in that same spirit of camaraderie that we see throughout the craft beer industry. So I've been doing that for a while, and as I got more and more into it, the job really started to evolve into more of a training type of role, because, you know, I could stand in front of a bartender and talk until I'm blue in the face about why he or she needed to pour the beer a certain way. But if they didn't really understand what beer was and understood any of the nuances of flavor or any of that, they weren't going to appreciate the message of quality and trying to preserve the flavors of the beer as it was originally created. So I found myself in a lot of instances, you know, talking to people about just what beer was. So in order to preach a message of quality, I ended up having to start with just basic beer education, because as you all know, and a lot of the listeners of this podcast know, there's still a lot of people out there who are really just learning about what beer is. And so, you know, how can you really care about preserving the flavor of beer when you don't even really fully understand beer to begin with? And that was a lot of what attracted me to the Cicerone program when Ray started it in 2008, was, you know, that they were going out there and giving people an incentive to learn more about beer, to, you know, really step up and pay attention and learn more and learn as much as they can, and that filling that void that was there was really going to help the industry overall and help overall quality of beer. And so I've been doing that ever since. And when Boulevard became part of Duvel USA in 2014, I translated that role to our current larger portfolio, which includes Brewery Omegang and several imported beers, and keep carrying the flag all the way up till today.
All right, guys, we'll be right back. We're going to take a little break and talk about new releases.
Oh, you let your feet run wild. Thomas Comas, we all go down.
All right, guys, we got a lot of releases coming up this month.
Yes.
As we mentioned in our last podcast, with the release of Thread Spinner.
Yes.
Is this week. Thread Spinner is one in a three-part series that we're doing for our Legendary series now through the next year almost.
Yeah, it's like a little mini-series within the series.
So the first one is Thread Spinner. This is a barley wine that has been aging in Witherspoon barrels for the last... while. It's been in there for a while, and we're super excited to
and
get that out.
Big.
It's a big beer.
It's
so that's
big.
That's coming out this week. Look at your look for your look
look at them.
Look at it. Just look at it.
Just
get it. It's so good. Big and Boozy at local craft retailers this week. Also coming out is Holiday Bonus. It's our festive porter. It's a robust porter that we brew every year with chocolate and orange peel. It's an awesome beer, super awesome for this time of year when everything starts cooling off a little bit. Also coming out for North Texas Beer Week is the return of Wild Manimal. Wild Manimal is a hoppy red that we ferment with Brett. It's a Brett beer, so it's a wild ale, and it is also aged in barrels. Yes. So we have we got a lot of really really awesome beer coming out this month. So yeah, go find it.
Get
after it.
Get it.
Do you dare to look them right in the eyes? Yeah. Oh, God save me, run you down, down to the door. Yeah, someday we run you down, down to the floor.
That's awesome. So let's talk. Let's kind of get into the nitty gritty of it a little bit. You know, let's explain to our listeners why a properly maintained and clean draft line matters to get the most out of the beer.
Well, I'll happily take that on. You know, stuff grows in beer. Beer has a lot of food for microorganisms like yeast and bacteria and mold, and many of these things can negatively affect the flavor of the beer. I often compare it to a leftover container in a kitchen. So if you have like food and you put your leftovers in the container and you keep it in there for a week or whatever, or maybe even not a week, you keep it in there for a couple days, you eat the food out of there, and then you fill it again with more leftovers and you never clean it, imagine what that container is going to look like. So that's similar to what we have in beer. The notable difference would be that there could be pathogens growing in your leftover container, and there are no pathogens that are going to grow in beer. So we aren't at risk of getting sick, but we are at risk of ruining the flavor of the beer.
Mm-hmm.
So if beer lines, if the biological matter that is naturally growing in a draft line is not cleaned out periodically, it will ultimately spoil the flavor of the beer. And the most common off flavors that you would get would be the common butter or butterscotch characteristic from diacetyl, which is produced by Pediococcus bacteria, or a sour flavor that is produced also by Pediococcus or by Lactobacillus.
Mm-hmm.
Those are probably the most common flavors, you know, in my experience of working with draft beer and draft systems for 15 years plus. That's what I've encountered the most over the years. So, and that's really the basics of why we need to keep draft lines clean.
Mm-hmm.
Really it's kind of where the rubber meets the road of quality. You know, that's like item number one in my book of maintaining the quality of draft beer. If you're not cleaning your draft lines, your beer's going to taste bad.
Right. Absolutely. You know, we have followed the draft quality manual book since day one to really make sure that all the beer that we're putting so much energy into is the way that we want it to be presented and the way that we want it to taste. But as you know, Neil, as you said, draft systems, there are no two draft systems alike, and you know, some people are running it through their rafters and not insulating their lines, or you know, doing all kinds of things that are not only wasting beer because you're waiting for those lines to cool down and you're just pouring out foam, but really not a great environment to just let beer sit in when the bar closes down at the end of the night, just to let that heat up. What are just a couple of steadfast rules you would tell anyone installing a draft system that they should adhere to?
Well, you want to, you know, to reiterate the point I made earlier, you want to keep everything clean. That's very important. You want to make sure that that the beer is kept cold, and you want to make sure that the beer is fresh. So, you know, clean, cold, and fresh would probably be the three basic things that you want to make sure you're taking care of. You know, to dive a little bit deeper, you know, one of the things that that I see most often screwed up, besides, you know, line cleaning issues, would be dispense gas issues. This is kind of a subject is kind of near and dear to my heart. I do a lot of education and preaching about setting up gas systems the right way, because there are some types of gas that you can use to push the beer from the keg to the faucet that preserves the character of the beer, and then there are other types of gases that will do the same thing, push the beer from the keg to the faucet, will actually ruin the flavor of the beer.
Mm-hmm.
So without getting too technical, you know, that's a big issue in draft beer, and so I've spent a lot of time working with draft system installers and retail owners and managers, and trying to make sure that the right type of system is being put in that's going to preserve the flavor of beer all the way from the keg to the faucet.
Mm-hmm. You don't want to push with air. Don't put an air compressor in.
You don't want to push with air. Yeah. And the other big one is not pushing regularly carbonated beer with a gas that is designed for a nitro beer. So a nitro beer like Guinness, for example, would be the most common example out there. Those nitrogen-infused beers need a blend of CO2 and nitrogen that has a very low percentage of CO2, usually around 25%. And that blend of gas is really easy to obtain pre-mixed in a cylinder. And you can get it really easy from just about any gas supplier in any market. And it's super easy and super cheap to take that gas and hook it up to your draft system and push your beer over a long distance, because you need some type of blended gas to push beer over a long distance. Well, if you use that blended gas, it's going to make your beer go flat in the keg. And a lot of people either don't realize it or don't care, or both, and continue to use these premixed cylinders with very low percentage CO2 mm-hmm. to push regularly carbonated beers. And so they make their beer go flat. And so you end up sitting down at a bar and you get a beer that has no head and is filled all the way up to the brim of the glass and has no fizz and no life and tastes bad.
Mm-hmm.
Your average consumer, you know, might just perceive that as something is not right. They aren't necessarily thinking, oh, this beer is flat, or, you know, most people are definitely not going to know that it's something to do with the draft system. I think a lot of people are going to drink a beer that's flat on a system like that and blame it on the brewery.
Right.
So if they have a Lakewood beer that is flat on tap because somebody's using nitro gas to pour it, they're going to think, man, that Wim doesn't make very good beer over at Lakewood, right?
Right.
So we want to make sure that they're putting the right blend of gas on these long draw systems to not just push the beer from A to B, but to also preserve the character of the beer and preserve the carbonation of the beer.
Absolutely.
So that would be another. That's another big issue that I'm battling that all the time out in the market.
Sure. Sure. All right, guys, we're going to take a little break, and we are going to talk about events, and then we'll be right back with Neil Whitty and Ray Daniels.
All right, yeah, we have a lot of cool events coming up.
Yeah.
Saturday, October 29th, it is our annual Let's Get Weird Halloween party, and guys, you don't want to miss this. This is going to get weird. Like, we always get a little weird, but this is going to get real weird.
It's going to be big.
It's going to be big. And we're going to have some really cool beers out at this thing. You can get tickets now for that. Check our Facebook and our events calendar right now.
So the Let's Get Weird party is going to be one of the biggest things that we have ever done at the brewery. We are going to have a little, almost a little mini beer fest out there with all kinds of beers that we have. Just for this event, we will have flame eaters and sword swallowers
and wacky movies.
It's going to be an awesome
circus freaks.
It's going to be a freak show.
Weird music
right before
acts.
Halloween.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
Come dressed up as your favorite Pokemon.
Yeah.
Yep.
Cosplay encouraged.
Cosplay encouraged.
Then, starting on the weekend of November 11th, 12th, 13th, is the beginning of North Texas Beer Week. And kicking it off on Friday, November 11th, we will be hosting the annual Comedy Brouhaha at the brewery. And you can get your tickets for that. And come on out. Watch some good comedy, some stand-up, get some beers. It'll be a good night. Then kicking off North Texas Beer Week that Monday, we are going to be hosting a live North Texas Beer podcast panel here at the brewery.
Yes.
And it's going to be really cool. We're going to have a lot of the heavy hitters and the old timers from the industry that really got this beer scene started coming out, and they will be taking questions and comments from the audience. So you can check our Facebook and our website for tickets.
Tickets super limited. Get it early. This is going to be awesome.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
First of its kind event, and we're really excited. And this will take the spot of next month's podcast. It's going to be a live event, but we're also going to have the recording on the podcast in case you couldn't make it out or didn't. Shame on you. But it's going to be awesome.
And then, of course, North Texas Beer Week goes on all that week. And check our events calendar for all of the events because we have a lot of them coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Saturday, November 12th, we will be at Untapped Dallas. So that's always a fun party. Live music, lots of cool bands, lots of great beers. Come on out and see us then. So that's what's going on.
Awesome. Thanks, Craig.
Be there.
Sure thing.
Ray, what are you battling? What are sort of the big sticking points on your end of things?
Well, I think certainly all of that is part of it. We're trying to get people to make sure they're serving their beer properly, and when they're dealing with an installed draft system, that they don't start monkeying with it and screw things up when they were set up properly. Probably the single most common thing that happens at retail is bar gets a delivery on Friday. Going to be a busy night, and the beer is warm when it arrives, or not warm to the touch. It feels cold, but it's say 50 degrees instead of 38, which is the operating temperature for American draft systems. And so they throw the beer on and start to pour it, and it's just a foamy mess.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they call the rep or the distributor and yell at them, and there's nothing they can do about it because the beer's warm. Or maybe they go down and they start monkeying around with the pressure settings in the cooler because, just about every guy who's ever, pumped a party pump at a kegger thinks he understands the dynamics of carbonation in beer. And so people go down and start monkeying around with the pressure settings on the draft system, and maybe they improve things, maybe they don't. But the bottom line is now they've thrown the system out of whack.
Right.
And now they're starting to affect the quality of all the beers on that system. And, things just kind of go downhill from there. So that's one of them. And we definitely, at the first level, we teach people, we basically tell people, do not touch the draft system.
Right.
Don't touch the pressure settings. Don't change anything because you're not educated enough on this stuff to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can change a keg. You can pour a beer. Other than that, call somebody who knows more than you do. So that's certainly one level. I think, draft cleaning is such a huge thing. And we know in the vast majority of bars and restaurants in the United States, the people who own and operate the bar rarely do the draft cleaning. It's usually some outside group. It's either an independent service that comes in and cleans the lines for you, or in a lot of states like Texas, it's the distributor reps who come in and clean the lines.
Right.
And but the retailer ultimately is the person whose business is going to rise or fall on the quality of the beer that's going through those lines. Mm-hmm. So the retailer, a certified Cicerone who's managing the beer program, needs to be darn sure that they know the right way to clean lines and that they are keeping an eye on the people who are cleaning those lines.
Mm-hmm.
So that their lines are getting cleaned properly and the beer quality coming through their system remains the highest it can possibly be.
Right.
So we really work that hard and certified Cicerone. And I know people probably think it's silly sometimes because, again, these people, most of them are never going to clean a line in their life. But you can't supervise it properly. You can't know whether your system's being handled properly by these outside parties if you don't understand the real details and you don't really understand, you know, how it's supposed to be done. So we push on that really, really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of stuff. And then I think for us the next big issue is just about the conversation that happens between customer and server, between customer and bar in general. And I've sort of, you know, done talks in the past to some trade groups talking about, you know, the biggest sins that bars do in terms of offering beers, presenting beers. And some of those are personal for me, but I think they're very important in the dialogue. And one of them is, you know, a beer list that doesn't have alcohol contents on it.
Okay.
Because in this day and age, you know, you know, tell me, you know, Wim's Best Beer, that could be a 2.5% Berliner Weiss, or it could be a 16% Imperial Stout. And on the basis of that title, I have no idea where in that range it might sit.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In the UK, we've been working on adapting the program for the UK, and over there it is a legal requirement that the alcohol content of the beer be presented to the consumer at the point of purchase.
That's interesting.
It's usually on the pump clip and on the menu when you walk into the bar. And, you know, in the United States, the reverse used to be true. Until about, I don't know exactly when the law changed, but 97, somewhere in that 97, 98 time frame, until then it was illegal in the United States, illegal for a brewer to put the alcohol content of their beer on their label.
Yeah.
And that goes back to our American lager culture of the late 20th century and the fact that all the beers were essentially the same and they didn't want, you know, consumers making buying decisions on the basis of a tenth of a percent difference in alcohol content. So they just banned people from putting that on their labels.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you know, they woke up and realized we're not doing anybody any favors to have, you know, 10, 12, 16% beers going out there without the consumer being given notice that this is an incredibly strong beer that they should be aware of.
Right.
So, you know, stuff like that, that's number one. And then we get into the basic, you know, dialogue, being able to talk about flavors, having familiarity with the catalog of styles, to be able to talk to people about and describe those styles. And that's a constant, you know, struggle. Just this weekend, I went into Euclid Hall here in Denver.
Yep.
And, you know, a bunch of great beers from local breweries. And for the most part, you know, we certainly don't know the beers. We barely know the breweries in a lot of cases. And one of the beers on the list that I thought sounded pretty good was a Vienna. So I asked the server, how's the Vienna? And he kind of made a face. And, you know, okay. And we asked about a couple more. And we wound up ordering tasters of four different beers. And we got the four tasters. And the Vienna was the best beer out of the group. Far away. And not that the others were necessarily bad, but it was just a really nice example of a Vienna style, very well-made beer.
Right.
And the beer that server liked the most was a brown ale that was a total diacetyl bomb. So it's like, okay,
yeah.
Nice effort. But a little off on the recommendations.
And that's very frustrating for, you know, for breweries. You know, the bartenders are the first line of defense, and they are also the first contact point, and most people who walk into a bar who may not be all that versed in craft beer are going to ask the bartender's recommendation. And if the bartender's palate is off, or if they're just, you know, trying to push a certain beer, maybe because it's getting out of date, that's not doing anyone any favors.
Well, you know, one of the things that if I get in my soapbox for a minute,
sure.
is really about diversity. Back when I was director of craft beer marketing for the Brewers Association, I started that job in late 2003, and this was right when craft beer was waking up, when the second wave was beginning. First wave was in the early 90s, and there was a crash from about 97 to 2002, 2003, and things were just starting to wake up, and that's when we started calling it craft beer instead of microbreweries.
Mm-hmm.
And the two main themes, and you know, Charlie Capazzi and I sat down when I first took the job, because it was he and I that were most often talking to the media, and it was like the things media were asking us was like, why is the craft beer thing, you know, popular? Why is it of interest? And the two things we said is flavor and diversity. You know, people want a flavorful beer that's different from just an American or international lager, and they like variety. They like being able to get different flavors, different times, to suit their mood, to suit the occasion, to suit the season, whatever it is. And so that's really always been a hallmark of American craft beer, is that variety of flavors.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we've kind of drifted into here in recent years is the everything's an IPA sort of version of craft beer. And for those of us, and I'll include Neil in this, you know, who've been around since the first wave, it's a little frustrating and mystifying, I guess, to kind of look and see, like, is all we've done is replace the tyranny of American lager, which is what existed 35 years ago, with the tyranny of IPA, then we really haven't made that much progress.
Right.
So, it's a little, and I know from a brewery's point of view, you go into a bar and the bar says, well, you know, your new brewery never heard of you. Give us your IPA and we'll try it out. And if people like it, then maybe we'll try some of your other beers. And so the brewery, you know, the sort of drive or demand to make an IPA is pretty strong. On the other hand, if those craft breweries of the 1980s had brewed the beers that bars wanted them to make, we wouldn't have any craft beer.
Right.
They would have all made American lagers.
Yeah.
Right. So that, in fairness to the community, and I've certainly seen this in Denver in the last few days, you know, breweries are starting to move away and not just do the IPA flagship, and they're doing new and different things. And I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing even here just in the last few months in terms of new styles, new varieties coming into the game.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what came first? It's a little chicken and egg. Was it the IPA drinker or was it the IPA? Are sour beers the next IPA? But that's a subject for another podcast.
No, I would say sours, and I'm seeing more and more lagers, which honestly I'm pretty excited about because there's a lot of great lagers out there.
And we'll be right back after this.
This is the part where I thank Kalea for the use of their song, tell people to go check them out at Untapped Dallas, and all this other junk I usually put here goes. I'll record that Monday. Yay.
So I'm gonna ask a question to both of you guys. Is there a difference between off flavors and a true infection? Whoever
Absolutely.
Wants to take that. Okay, go ahead.
So yeah, I mean, an infection is what you call something that has some type of living microorganism that is causing that off flavor. So you have an off flavor from an infection that would be, for example, the things that I referenced before, the Pediococcus or Lactobacillus infection in the draft line.
Right, but that could be coming from the brewery as well.
It could absolutely be coming from the brewery.
Right.
So it doesn't have to come from a draft line, but that is an example of what we would say an off flavor from infection.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also have an off flavor from some process related stuff. I think, you know, the one that pops to mind would be DMS. So maybe you haven't gotten a vigorous enough boil on the brew house and you're left with DMS in the beer, so your beer kind of smells like cooked corn. That would be considered an off flavor, and it is not the result of some type of bacterial infection.
Right.
Yeah, there's absolutely a difference there.
Yeah, and I think a lot of consumers, you know, go straight because they're not educated, and we don't expect them to be. I mean, you know, not every consumer is going to go through a Cicerone program or a BJCP program or go to a day of off-flavor tasting. And, you know, it's on us as not just as the industry, but as beer educators and beer stewards to make sure that we have a way to educate the public to give them better information and make them discern exactly what is going on with the beer to help us make better beer.
Yeah, and it goes back to what Ray said of teaching people to be able to use words appropriately to describe what's going on in the beer.
Right.
I don't know how many times I've seen someone who's never had an IPA before take their first sip of an extremely bitter beverage and say that it's skunky.
Right.
And, you know, it's just a misidentification of the flavor and, you know, and misuse of that term.
Right.
You know, that particular one I blame on a very successful ad campaign from Anheuser-Busch from, oh, God, probably the mid-90s,
yeah,
where the guy was running around looking for skunky beer. I'm looking for skunky beer. And it, like, pounded that phrase into the American psyche in the mid-90s. And I still am seeing the effects of that. So, and there's a lot of that out there, people using the wrong term to describe something. And, you know, and sometimes it doesn't matter, but, you know, if it's just like a friend talking to a friend. But in our business, it matters a lot. You know, because we want people to be able to constructively talk about what's going on with the beer. If there's something wrong with it, we want to be able to fix it. We want to be able to address it. And if people can't express that appropriately, it makes it a lot more difficult.
I would encourage people that if you do have a problem with the beer, if you think there's an issue with the beer, reach out to the brewery directly. Because we obviously always want to make better beer, and we obviously always want to be listening to our consumers. And if there is something wrong with any beer, we want to fix it. So,
yeah.
So one other question for you guys. Let's talk about brewery labs and and this is for both of you. What's the importance of having a lab incorporated into a brewery's QC program? And when should it be instituted?
Well, I think it's important for a brewery to have a QC program. And then lab, you know, is just a place. What you really need to be doing is certain examinations of your materials and your beers, and those might be instrumental tests, those might be sensory evaluations, and you know, there are some things that are pretty common sense across the board for all types of beers. And then there's some stuff that might be specific to the type of beer you're making or to your specific operation, depending upon the spectrum of beers that you're trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I will say that the specifics of which tests and when are beyond, you know, my experience and the specifics of my training. So maybe Neil can address that more effectively.
Well, you know, I agree that, you know, quality programs to varying extents should be implemented with any brewery, no matter what size. You know, if you're you're an upstart making very little beer, you should be doing some basic types of quality checks, even if it's just, you know, some controlled sensory evaluation. You know, if you're dealing with propagations at all, I mean, it's, you know, having a microscope is a great kind of starting point. You know, measuring viability, cell count in your yeast is a really basic thing that just about every brewer should be doing. And then as you grow, you know, it's an incremental development of that program, starting to possibly do microchecks, check for any type of spoilage organisms in beer. Maybe you start at a single process point, and you know, measure, do some micro testing on beer right before it's packaged, for example. Then maybe you expand that to several process points and rinse water on tanks after you've cleaned them, and expand it from there. You know, maybe you invest in a CO2 meter, a little basic Zamen-Nagel that you can do some carbonation checks and dial that in more specifically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of it depends on your resources, the nature of your brewery. You know, are you sending packaged beer out the door from day one? Are you serving beer right out of a tasting room? You know, there are certain the nature of your business is going to determine how extensive your quality program is. But as your brewery grows, so should your quality program. And eventually, maybe you do actually have a physical lab area, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, you know, and that's what, you know, I've seen with Boulevard over the years. And we didn't really have much in the way of quality checks to begin with. We had a microscope. We had a few things that we did, and I remember when we hired our first full-time lab technician, it was a big step forward for us. I remember when we first implemented sit-down, controlled QC tastings of all the batches of beer before they went out the door. They were super informal at first. Now they're extremely organized,
mm-hmm.
With iPads and data going into a database. You know, I remember the first micro checks that we did, and now, you know, we've got a full-on microbiologist on staff that deals with exclusively that. So, you know, now we've got 5 full-time lab technicians. So there's, you know, there's been a development over the years, and it's been incremental. There wasn't any one point where all of a sudden, boom, we had 3 lab technicians and a full-blown lab. It should grow and develop along with your business.
Sure. And I've seen the lab at Boulevard. It is impressive. And it's a multi-room lab. No, it's very impressive. You guys have a lot of really nice toys that I'm sure our lab technician would love to get his hands on, but not quite yet.
Yeah, we do have some fun stuff to play around with.
Yeah, you do. Go ahead, Ray.
Oh, I was going to say that this conference I'm at now, World Brewing Congress, there's a lot of talk about sensory and a lot of folks here that run sensory programs for breweries. And saw a good talk the other day Dr. Bill Simpson from Aroxa that produces off flavors was talking about training and basically saying, you know, your tasters are athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to train them. You can't go out and run a marathon, you know, without training for it. And you can't sit down and detect a wide range of potential off flavors in beer without being trained to do that.
Yeah.
And just because you trained for a marathon a year ago, if you haven't been training for the past year, you couldn't just, you know, walk out and go run one tomorrow. So, you know, it's a matter of training people, preparing people, and then retraining them and re-preparing them, validating them, and making sure that they still have those chops over and over again. So it's a very managed and very precise process for doing that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And not everyone can taste every off flavor.
No, I say that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
We all have blind spots. And you know, the journey of tasting is a lifelong journey. You know, I think there are always things that you're learning, always things that you're starting to be able to identify and pick up. And you're learning, like, where your blind spots are, you know, for you personally.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you both for your lifelong journey in beer. And thank you guys for joining us on the program. It's been a lot of fun. It's been super informative. And I'm sure our listeners are going to be Googling the Cicerone program very, very soon. And you know, increasing their knowledge of beer and what they're tasting out in the bar and at home. So thank you guys so much for everything that you do for the industry and for fighting the good fight.
Thanks,
Glenn.
Thank you. Great to see your progress and success.
Thank you, sir. And we'll
Absolutely.
See you guys next time you're in town. Well, thank you again for listening, everyone. This has been Taproom Talks. Thank you again to Neil Witte and Ray Daniels for joining us today. If you like us, tell a friend. Go to bit.ly/taproomtalks to find us on iTunes or Google Play. And you can find us on the interwebs at lakewoodbrewing.com, on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Lakewood Brewing. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye, friends.
Goodbye, Nick.
Three Migos.
Oh, it's been forever.
Good night, Ned. And you can follow us at lakewoodbrewing.com, Twitter, or Instagram.
Or Facebook.
What?
It's Facebook, too. I didn't write it on. That's bullet points. You're supposed to riffle.
This isn't a bullet point. This is actually a paragraph.
Okay, that's fair. I'll put a bullet in you.
Grammar. Grammar Nazi.
Punctuation.
Okay. Should we do it again?
Find us on.
Do you want to do it?
No. Nah.